Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and with me today is Dr. Emily Zarka, the host and monster fan of the PBS digital series Monstrum, which you can find on the PBS Storied YouTube channel and the PBS Passport app. And this series is so lovely. The me being a monster fan, a monster movie aficionado, having all of these monsters, many of whom I've heard of, some of which I have not, has been a delight the past few years. Emily, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we are here because one of your upcoming episodes is about King Kong. And we have a movie, Kong versus Godzilla, coming out. And tell us about the history of King Kong.
Yeah, so I think that I should say I'm a kaiju fan as a whole in general. If you've seen my Godzilla episode, you know that Mothra is my girl. I think she's fantastic. But of course, a lot of people actually want to point to King Kong as being the first kaiju or strange beast of, you know, sizing up these creatures and having them sort of engage in battles. And I'm not sure if I subscribe to that, but I think the history of King Kong itself, even outside of the kaiju genre, is really interesting. So King Kong was originally released in 1933, which was while the Great Depression was happening. You know, the effects of World War I were still lingering. There was a lot of immigration to the United States. And of course, there was a very contentious time for racial relations in the United States. And all of those things we can see come through in King Kong, which a lot of people don't want to expect necessarily from, you know, a movie about a giant gorilla. But once you sort of know the history and sort of the illusions that are happening in the film, I think it makes it very interesting. And some people think that a lot of those things, including the problematic racial depiction of King Kong, make people want to shy away from talking about that. And I think that's actually doing not just Kong, but like U.S. history a disservice. So the episodes for Monstrum, actually, the first one's going to look at the context of the 1933 film and sort of what it represented at that time in the United States and in the globe. And then it's actually going to be a part two because there's so much to talk about. I will be talking about Kong in the 21st century and asking the question of, have we actually come far enough to modernize Kong adequately for our current moment in time?
Well, I and a lot of other people are fans of Kong Skull Island and yes. where we're going forward with this monster verse and the whole connection with Monarch and the Titans and the other monsters. So this is a fun time to be a monster fan. And for the record, I'm a Godzilla fan, but I'm also a Rodan fan. So
okay, all right. Everyone has their favorite. I totally get it. I'm glad you mentioned Skull Island because I actually love Kong Skull Island. And I think that at least from the research that I did looking at King Kong, you know, the past, his entire history sort of in pop culture, I think that Skull Island does a lot of things right. And one of them is actually completely removing sort of the incredibly stereotypical and racialized problematic relationship between Kong and like a beautiful blonde white woman. And I also think that Skull Island taps into what I think makes the best kaiju films and just the best monster films in general is actually looking at the effects of war and the Vietnam War and actually giving us like social commentary alongside some of those like cool, you know, kaiju battles. So I'm glad to hear from a fellow Skull Island fan.
So what was the timing? I mean, was it always going to be you'd get to King Kong eventually and just it just happened to to coincide with this new movie?
Yeah, again, as I'm a fan of the genre, so when I saw that the new you know, Kong Godzilla New Empire was coming out, it just felt like the right time. We've gotten a lot of requests to do King Kong previously, and we've been, you know, expanding not in the last, I would say, two seasons, not just looking at more niche folkloric monsters, which are bread and butter, and I love doing that, but looking a little bit more broadly at some of the, you know, prominent pop culture monster figures. And we did an episode about Jaws, a little while back, and that was really fun. And frankly, since I am the researcher, writer, and host, I get to have a little bit of creative control. And it just was something that the more I started looking into, I was like, we need to be talking about Kong now and see what happens. Because as we know from the trailers, right, the new movie, he's not species, which has been sort of Kong's narrative arc since like 2005. So I'm curious to see what they're going to do with his story moving forward.
Yeah, that whole extended trailer where you see this whole other world of giant apes, I'm like, oh, what are we gonna do here? I'm curious where they're gonna take it. I really am, because if they do it badly, it's just, you know, a giant version of Planet of the Apes, and that's not Kong. I'm sorry, that is not King Kong.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm very curious to see, and I don't want to make any assumptions yet without having seen it, but giving some of the problematic stereotypical relationships and representations that Kong had initially, I'm hesitant to see how they're going to sort of expand his species like culture to a degree, because it definitely seems, at least from the trailer, right, that which makes sense, that not all of, you know, Kong's people are protectors of humanity, which is fine in itself, but I don't know, it's going to be like Kong versus them, Kong versus himself. I'm curious to see.
So talk a little bit about the research you did into the problematic aspects of the 1933 Kong, because that's gone into great detail in this first episode. Mm-hmm. And I knew a lot of it. I just hadn't realized how just saturated into the media promotion for the movie it was back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, again, looking at King Kong's influences, there's a lot of things going on there. But for me, Kong is, at least the original, is ultimately about conquest and colonialism, where, you know, these white people are going to non-white communities and like discovering them. And there was actually, at the time, documentary film genre was focusing a lot on this like ethnographic type of exploration film, where they were doing basically what the, you know, filmmakers in King Kong were doing. We're finding these, you know, indigenous or native populations and making them into a spectacle that was somehow lesser than. So we definitely see that coming across in King Kong and the representation of the island's inhabitants in a lot of ways. But what the other thing that I found really interesting in my research that I personally wasn't aware of is before King Kong's release as well, there was this weird horror subgenre of, there's a movie called The Gorilla and then The Ape, which are about gorillas, or rather actors in gorilla suits, like violently murdering humans. And there was a really terrible racial exploitation film called Ngagi, and where African women are actually offered as sexual sacrifice to gorillas, which of course is like disgusting and so much going on there. But that was an incredibly popular film, like considered a box office success. And I couldn't find anyone who said this outright in my research, but it's my belief that the success of these problematic racist exploitation films involving gorillas contributed to RKO Radio Pictures' ability to invest in the King Kong, because they thought maybe it was going to be a success based on, you know, the kind of few years before. And once you're aware, like you said, it seems super obvious, but then once you kind of tilt your head at it, it becomes more and more problematic. Where, I mean, at the very base level, King Kong is a so-called savage, black, muscular, you know, non-white creature who is obsessed with this white woman for no apparent reason other than the fact that she is beautiful and blonde and white. And I think that for the creators of the film, whether they want to admit it or not, but certainly for the viewers of the film, during its original theatrical release, there was definitely going to be comparisons between Kong and actual black men in the United States, and sort of the sexual fears of white culture regarding black men and white women and interracial relationships in general. And of course, Kong is captured and chained and exploited for profit at the behest of these white Americans. I mean, we can very clearly see the parallels to the plights of enslaved people. And this was definitely something that Americans at the time and globally would have been aware of in the conversation. So Kong is a complicated text. And I don't want to dismiss some of the things that King Kong, the original film, did fantastically. I mean, it was very notable for its use of special effects and stop motion capture. And there was a lot of work that people like Willis Harold O'Brien did to make those things possible. And so Kong in itself, if we take it out of the racial context, has some really interesting elements just about cinematic history. But I think that we cannot truly disassociate Kong from that racial history. And that's something that a lot of artists and creators have, you know, dealt with in various ways since that 1933 first film.
Talk a little bit about the research you did into these special effects, because technically that was like a groundbreaking movie when it came to the use of models and stop motion animation. Mm-hmm. It really sort of pushed the bar, technologically speaking, forward quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that's incredible. And I think that that's, we can see that trickle down also even to some of the other kaiju films eventually. That, you know, one of the reasons that kaiju films were such a big deal is because King Kong re-releases after World War II were received really well by the Japanese population. But thinking about the stop motion special effects, again, mostly at the helm of Willis Harold O'Brien, there were two main filmmakers for the original Kong, one of them being Marion C. Cooper. And he likes to claim that he was the one who first, you know, sized up Kong from like a just traditional gorilla to like a larger than life size. But there's actually evidence that shows that it was O'Brien who made these initial sort of portraits to pitch to the studio. And he was the one in those portraits that he created that made Kong so much larger and like the icon that we know him to be now. So from the very basic level, I think that he's behind that. And then we also had the incredible sculpture work that was done behind the scenes as well, that I think, again, all of this is to say that movies are not just made by one individual. And that's something that, you know, I've seen in a lot of the film stuff that I've covered on Monstrum and I like to remind people of, so thank you for asking, is that it's not just the directors or not just the screenwriter, that there's all these people behind the scenes contributing to these like icons in my mind of pop culture and of history. So yeah, I think that King Kong and the special effects, they had enough money from RKO, and RKO was kind of desperate for a hit, and they happened to pick the right people, and sort of the stars aligned in all the right ways.
I think that's one of the trade-offs of the newer monster movies, the newer kaiju movies that we have gotten and we're going to get. We're losing the artistry in making models of these monsters. They're, you know, they're like 98% digital now. And even though they look better because of the software, the technology we have of creating these monsters digitally, and when they eventually become toys on the shelves for us to buy, they are not as just to say, they're not as detail oriented. They don't look as good. And, you know, part of me every now and then wants to look at, okay, what's the new Godzilla look like? What's the new toy? Is this the 6-inch toy? Is this the 18-inch toy?
Yeah.
Oh, look, they're talking about making a Rodan, but it's been 3 years now and it hasn't come out yet. So yeah, there's...
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think that, not to say that obviously that the special effects stuff that happens now isn't, you know, an artistry in itself, but I do think that there is something about the care, like the idea that these monsters could be like physically held in their initial creation, even before they became toys. There's something I think really special about practical effects. And I'm a huge fan of practical effects whenever they're used. I think we've come too far, like you said, that I don't think we can really go back now. I wish we could. Maybe I know that they do some motion capture for the kaiju in the more modern films, so maybe it's more, at least I would like to see more of that, like behind the scenes stuff, so maybe I get to feel a little bit more of that realism. So I think that's what these films come down to, and maybe that's one of the things, like you said, we have lost with moving from the stop motion effects and the models, is they're it's realistic enough, which seems ridiculous considering, you know, that Godzilla would end up, you know, like Mecha Godzilla and like Space Godzilla and all these like other crazy kaiju that popped up. But they're so, to me, Godzilla's so reptilian in a way that seems very believable. And obviously with like Kong, I mean, gorillas are around and they're incredibly strong and intelligent. And there's enough of that sort of real world that just sized up and becoming larger than life. I think that allows us to transcribe more meaning onto these beings. At least I like to think so. But it's not like this is a completely crazy, you know, Lovecraftian Cthulhu type creature that feels so otherworldly. To me, the kaiju feel like they could be something that we could see in the real world.
Well, talk about the connection to Godzilla, because you've already done an episode on Godzilla. How are you melding these two worlds, being a fan of both?
Being a fan of both, I was a little bit aware of, you know, the initial sort of history because Godzilla and Kong fought each other way back, right, in like the 60s or the 70s. It was 1962. Yeah. King Kong versus Godzilla. So as I mentioned that King Kong's 1933 release was very successful, but then after World War II, given obviously the sort of delay of Hollywood, producing a whole lot of new films during the war and then recovering from the war and, things like film shortages or restrictions of what actually, you know, cinematographers had to work with at the time, we saw a lot of re-releases of older films of, you know, things that are essentially stock movies, for lack of a better way of putting them. And King Kong was one of those movies that was re-released and re-released, so much so that I believe in the 1950s, Time magazine declared it like the movie of the year, despite the fact that it was just a re-release, not, you know, an original film. And a lot of those re-releases happened overseas, including in Japan. And as I mentioned, King Kong was really successful in Japan. So we have that idea permeating in the minds of Japanese filmmakers. And then, of course, we can't take Godzilla away from the effects of the atomic bomb on Japan during World War II. We can clearly see that in the Godzilla film. So what's better than taking, like, you know, these cool two cool monsters that have like these really complex histories and putting them against each other? So Toho, the movie studio behind Godzilla, actually struck a deal with RKO to license Kong for that, you know, first 1962 battle on film. And they sized Kong up even larger than Hollywood did and, you know, made him into a formidable foe for Godzilla. And I think that's one thing that people have always loved. I mean, that's where I see, I guess, my appreciation for both coming in. Is there something just like really aesthetically and thematically pleasing about seeing like giant monsters fight each other? I don't know 100% why that is, but it looks cool. And like, we want to see who comes out on top. But I think what's really interesting in the last, you know, 10 or so years or 20 years, I guess, since the 21st century, we've seen, I mean, that's the whole line, right, in the Monsterverse, is that Godzilla is the defender of the planet and Kong is the defender of humanity. And like, when they decide to work together, that's hypothetically when, you know, the world is going to survive in like all the ways we want it to. And so I think that by making Godzilla an anti-hero and Kong a hero, we have a little bit of that balance where we get to see monsters fight other monsters. And I think there's something really therapeutic for us as humans to see that. And I do think it's interesting to note that a lot of the Kong remakes and releases, and Godzilla, of course, at the beginning, followed some kind of global conflict or major catastrophe. So I think that when we have these monster battles on screen, again, this larger than life capability, it's a way for us to process some of the grief and destruction that happens from war and real human conflict in a way that through this veneer of horror and science fiction. Of course, there's not, you know, however many hundreds of feet tall, you know, Godzilla and Kong are now. Those things aren't walking around on Earth, but, you know, processing the destruction that they do give. Because that's one thing that people kind of seem to forget, or it's not really addressed that much in the Godzilla films. So they've been getting a little bit better about that. Is, I mean, entire like cities are taken out and people are killed and populations. And the first Godzilla film, Gojira, Godzilla doesn't pop up the first 20 minutes in that one. And there's like in a lot of ways, I think the original Godzilla film is a giant like funeral for the Japanese people to process the grief and trauma of World War II from their perspective. Because we have these like really long funerary scenes, we see people evacuating, there's all this talk about radiation and the effects of it. Even one of the opening scenes, it like directly corresponds to an earlier event that same year of H-bomb testing of the US that in a Japanese fisher boat got caught up in that. So I think it's, I appreciate monsters that have, of course, it's the entire concept of monster, that have a historical connection that we can point to and learn something from. And I think that if we look past just the cool monster battles of Godzilla and Kong, we have those really complex histories that sure serve as both snapshots into moments of time, but also there's a reason their longevity, is still around. Because I think that if it was just about cool monster battles, we wouldn't be as invested in the MonsterVerse as a whole.
Yeah, I love the evolution of Godzilla over the past, I'm going to say 20 years or so. And last year I learned that the original novellas that were so popular in Japan, that Godzilla and Godzilla Raids Again, that were the basis of those first movies, they were never available in English until last year.
And the original manga that was like so big too wasn't translated into English until the 80s.
It
Which
just it like how much other Godzilla stuff is there? Because I think there's a Mothra story that hasn't been translated yet. So
Yeah, and of course, I would love to see that. No, when I was researching the Godzilla episode, I did a lot of research into Godzilla in like recent comic and manga adaptations. And one thing I guess I'm here to say is I wish more people would like look into that. And again, I wish more of it was translated from Japanese into English because some of really cool like character development and history stuff is happening in the literature components, not necessarily in the film components. And I mean, that's one of the things, right, about being a fan of something. You want to consume it all, and I just want to consume it all. But I thought there were some really interesting and kind of ridiculous. Like, I know there's like a Godzilla in Hell version and like Godzilla King of Monsters. There's all these different crazy things that Godzilla has done, including go to hell and like fighting against Kublai Khan and some other one, and just ridiculous in great ways, but some really interesting interpretations. I think it's Dark Horse Comics had a 19, like a late 1980s Godzilla that was actually, I believe, reprinted from the Japanese manga. I think that was like the first time. And there's some really interesting things there going on about like Cold War tensions and like Russia and the US. And that one stood out because the Japanese prime minister, they propose like dropping a nuclear weapon to get rid of Godzilla. And, the prime minister is like, are you basically like, are you kidding me in Japan? Like, are they out of their minds? We would never do that. So I think again, nodding to the original history of like the Godzilla in that continues more often in the comics and in the literature. And I know that with what was it, Godzilla? What was the one that just won the Oscar? It's escaping me right now. Not Sub-Zero. The most recent one.
Godzilla minus one.
Yes, thank you. Godzilla Minus One. Yeah, I mean that, hook us back in history, not to the original Godzilla, post-World War II, but definitely still dealing with a lot of the lingering effects of like American sort of, that's the thing, being an adult is so interesting. Like the things you learn that you weren't taught in textbooks, right? Is sort of the conditions of the Japanese surrender and a lot of the things that, happened in the country after the war and, are dealt with in Godzilla Minus One. Like the fact that they don't have weapons to fight back. It's just really interesting. And again, I think one of the reasons that's a great example, like we were talking about before, of how some really cool technical cinematic stuff happened. And I think that we see that actually a lot in horror and science fiction and kaiju films and these, for lack of a better way of putting it, like more popular genres, maybe, or the ones that aren't considered as dramatic. I think that the creators get to play around a little bit more and be a little more experimental. And I think that that trickles down into all genres of cinematography.
Yeah, Godzilla Minus One is absolutely gorgeous. I went to see it in IMAX and I was
Oh, lucky.
completely blown away. That was it was a visual feast. And as far as kaiju movies go, I was one of the people who was terribly, terribly disappointed that Pacific Rim didn't do better. I'm like, you have giant monsters and giant robots beating each other out like Rock'em Sock'em Robots throwback. And I'm like, why didn't this movie do better? Why didn't people go see this movie? It's incredible.
I know, I never saw the sequel, I'll admit, but I really liked the first one. And I think I'm terrified of robots. It's like one of my fears. People always ask me, I'm like, yeah, robots are terrifying. So, you know, having robots fighting kaiju was like hard for me to get behind. But I don't know. That's a really good question. I'd have to think about that a little bit more of why it wasn't as successful. And I think maybe because it was a little, I don't know.
Was it ahead of its time? You know, like, because it came out, 11 years ago now. And I couldn't believe that more people weren't just enamored with this movie, because monster movies, you know, monsters and giant robots fighting each other. I mean, if anybody who saw those trailers and didn't imagine Ripley in the loader fighting the alien queen, you know, and just go, okay, we've got that scene on like 100 times steroids. This is going to be fun.
I think, and this is going to be, this could probably be sound crazy and like obviously spoilers, but I think it might be because that they get a little bit into the supernatural or pseudoscience-y, which is also, I think, a flaw of the more recent Godzilla and Kong movie, right? That Ghidorah is like possessed, right? Mechagodzilla is like possessed by Ghidorah at the end, or like the dead severed head. And that also happens kind of in Pacific Rim, right? There's like that idea of drifting where they're trying to connect with the kaiju through some like telepathy, science fiction-y kind of connection. So like maybe that was why it didn't do as successful, right? Because it's like we have robots, we have kaiju, and now we have this other kind of mind melding thing that maybe it was just like too much.
I don't know why they decided to do that, but the drifting was supposed to make it so that the two pilots could pilot the robot better, because one person couldn't handle the the mental strain, the stress of that.
And that makes sense. But then like why just no one should be trying to drift or mind meld with like different species. Maybe that's where I have the problem with.
I think they treated it too comedically, maybe. Possibly. Yeah. But that's neither here nor there. But I'm looking forward to the new empire. Looking forward to where they take this further. The TV series on Apple TV, Monarch. The way that tied together the previous subtle appearances of Monarch in the previous movies was, I'm like, okay, you guys are sneaky. You've been planning this for a while. I like it.
And I like that. And I think that's one of the cool things when you do have these sort of, you know, legacy type monster platforms, is there's enough content, like you mentioned in the previous films, to, you know, build off of. And then in the literature and all the other adaptations that have happened, that this just seems like a really excellent like thing to mine. But again, I think what Monarch did is take it back in time and sort of deal with some of the, you know, social things going on in like the 1950s when Monarch was being formed. So yeah, I'm a fan of the show. I'm curious. And as we know, you know, Kong pops up at the very, very end of the last episode. So I'm curious how they're going to expand that if the series is renewed.
And we have, I don't even know what movie is planned after New Empire, but I'm curious to see.
Want a Mothra. I want a 21st century Mothra like movie. She's usually in the background and I want her to be in the foreground because she's my queen and I love her.
Everybody wants the queen of the monsters, Mothra. Like I said, that first trailer for was it King of the Monsters? When you see Rodan coming out of the volcano, I almost cried. That was so beautiful.
See, this is, I had the exact same reaction with Mothra spreading her wings like behind that waterfall. I was like, this is her. She's here.
Yeah, that was beautiful. And I like how they they captured the essence of Mothra in you see in her wings when she unfolds at Net, that one moment, I'm like, oh wow, she's gorgeous. Yeah. But then Rodan coming out of the fire was just, I had a little tear coming down my cheek. I'm like, oh, there is.
Well, see, maybe we can both be happy, because I know that Mothra and Rodan and Godzilla like band together at one point in a previous like 60s movie. So maybe both of us can be happy.
We can do that. We can do that. Also, the professor who translated the two Godzilla novellas last year, he wants to do the Mothra one. It's a whole rights thing with the estate. So
yeah.
I'm hoping he gets his wish and does the Mothra translation. So we can both look forward to that, you know, wish for that, put that out in the universe saying, hey,
I would love
make
that.
It happen.
Yeah. Let's manifest it.
So are there any other monsters on your slate coming up the rest of this season?
Coming up, we're still definitely planning, so still open to suggestions. Yeah, the King Kong, the two-parter is coming up. Super excited about that. And I'm actually going to dive a little bit more into some other sort of avenues we love, taking back to a folkloric monster. Haven't quite decided, but I'm thinking about La Lechuza. There. And one thing I can say that is coming is we're doing a Backrooms episode. I always have a really good time with the sort of very modern internet folkloric monsters. As a scholar, I think it's fascinating that we can timestamp a lot of that. Like literally we know the minute where like Slender Man date and time was invented. I think that's so cool because most of my research is, you know, digging through hundreds and hundreds of years trying to find entry points. So when we have it just brilliantly laid out so clearly, thanks to the internet, that's always fun. So do you know what the Backrooms are?
No.
Okay. So the Backrooms are fascinating. It's like a 21st century liminal space that I think really merges with like labyrinth type sort of mythology. So it came from a creepypasta in 2019, and it's a liminal space is basically where it's a location or a spot that feels familiar, but it's not because something's absent from it a lot of the time. Like it's getting into that uncanniness. So the original Backrooms, I believe, was like you're basically in an office building, you know, large carpeted open space room, yellow wallpaper, fluorescent lighting, but there's like no windows or doors and you just wander around aimlessly. And like, there's a vague sense that something is like stalking you or chasing you. But it's this idea that, again, I'm still exploring why, took off into like film adaptations and other YouTube channels and like video games, and people have continuously used it. And I think that's just really interesting. Like, how can an actual space become a monster? So we'll be exploring that this season in Monstrum as well.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
That it sounds like a haunted house chase setup where, you know, you go into a house and they scare you all the way through it.
Exactly, but you never quite get to see them, and like you don't know where you're going, and everything's like brightly lit, which to me makes that's like what I think Midsommar was really successful for me. It's one of my comfort watches, don't judge me. But I love Midsommar for a variety of reasons, and one is because I think it really messes with your idea of like what that kind of like cult and like gore should be around, which is usually like darkness and like dreariness or like wood scenes or, you know, winter. And it's set in this like absolutely idyllic, beautiful, brightly lit, very colorful, sunny countryside. And I think that makes it all the more terrifying. So I'm curious to see if there's a similar thing kind of going on with Backrooms.
Yeah. The impression I got from that was they were mocking the light.
Ooh. Okay. I like that. As a grad student.
Yeah, that's no, just my impression. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the PhD. I know I was talking to some of my friends and we're like, that's the true horror. If you've actually been, that's like the biggest fear with someone else and you're like program stealing your dissertation idea. And so that was the true horror for me, was the guy who took his dissertation.
Well, the first part of the King Kong episode will be airing on April 4th. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Right before or right after New Empire comes out. And I'm guessing you're working on part two after New Empire, so you get to absorb all that info from that.
Yep, we're going to film part two the day after I see the new movie, so I get to give my thoughts on that. But even without it, it's a really cool episode. And I believe that one is going to be airing on April 18th. So April is going to be the month of King Kong for Monstrum.
Cool. So we'll have links where people can find those episodes and also your old ones. Hat tip to the Jaws episode, by the way.
Thank you.
That's my first real big screen monster movie experience. Yeah. I saw that. I was like 10 years old watching the giant shark on the big screen going, whoa, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that intro, the beginning of that movie is like burned into my brain as a child. And I always already had a healthy fear of the ocean. There's no way I was going to be swimming in the dark after watching Jaws, that's for sure.
I have so many Jaws books and DVDs. It's not even funny. It's not even funny. And yes, I'm looking forward to next year when I can buy the 50th anniversary one to go up between the 35th anniversary and the 20th anniversary. And yeah.
You gotta have them all. I love that. Are you a shark fan in general?
I'm not really a shark fan in general. Okay. In the war between sharks and orcas, I'm totally, team orca. Mm-hmm. But there's something visceral about Jaws. And mm-hmm. I don't know if it's just the characters, the way that the characters are fighting themselves and the ocean, mm-hmm. or the fact that, I was an impressionable child when I first saw it.
I think it's both. What we talked about in the Jaws episode too, is that Jaws is in some ways like a slasher movie. It's definitely speaking to like a rising sub-horror genre as well. So that point of view, I mean, Jaws POV was huge to put you in the perspective of the actual non-human monster. I think that's really cool.
Yep. So we'll have links to where people can watch Monstrum, the new episodes about King Kong, as well as all of the old episodes. Emily, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Escape Pod, the free science fiction podcast brought to you by escape artists.
I rippled a welcoming cadence of light beneath my skin, and then, seeing the newcomer was human, made my best approximation of a smile. Welcome to Helixer Transgalactic Lounge.
Each week, one story told well.
She should have never come back to this God's forsaken junk heap of a space station. But she couldn't help but miss it when she was away for too long.
From the most astonishing and visionary storytellers of the genre.
But because time is a trick of the mind, it can be hacked. And we have gotten good at it. We had to.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or find us on the web at escapepod.org. And on Patreon under EA Podcasts.
Hi. This is Barbara Crampton, and you're listening to Slice of Sci-Fi. Ooh, scary.
Once again, that's Dr. Emily Zarka of PBS Digital's Monstrum series, which you can find on YouTube. I believe it's on PBS's Storied channel. We'll have a link to that. The first part of their King Kong episode airs April 4th, and part two will be airing April 18th. So I'm looking forward to seeing part two. Yes, I saw a sneak of part one. It's fabulous. And the detail as to which we may get to see future episodes of some of the other Titans, I think she would actually go comatose from glee doing a Mothra episode. But her love of monsters and folklore and legends really comes across in this series. So if you haven't seen it yet, if you haven't seen any of these episodes yet, please, please go check it out. And we'll also have a link to the interview I did last fall with Professor Jeffrey Engels, who did the first English language translation of the original novellas Godzilla and Godzilla Raids Again. And in that, we do talk about how, you know, there's a Mothra novella that exists and how he would like to be the one to translate that for an English-speaking audience as well. There's so much Godzilla out there. I like how with the newer movies, the focus is on the balance between Godzilla and Kong. And the, what was it? I believe it was over the holidays. There was a miniseries announced last summer, but I believe it came out over the holidays. Godzilla versus the Justice League. And when I saw the first cover art that was released, I was intrigued because it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous cover art. It really is. But I remember reposting that art on Twitter and saying, is it wrong that I'm rooting for Godzilla in this fight? And no, I have not yet read it. I don't even know if it's a one-shot or a mini-series or a limited series. I have no idea. I should probably find that out because I'm curious. Are they going to let Godzilla win? Godzilla versus Superman. Intriguing concept. I'm truly curious. Yeah, how are they going to work that? I mean, is Godzilla the bad guy? Really? After all of this that we've done the past 10 years, you're going to have Godzilla going up against the Justice League? Is this evil Justice League from Bizarro World? What's going on here? I should probably find out, but I'm not that curious. I just was enjoying the artwork that I saw come out about that particular series. And yes, Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, came out yesterday. So this is opening weekend. Lewis's review of it is online. I won't give any spoilers, but he gave it 3 out of 5 stars. So a lot of people might see that as a come down from King of the Monsters, but we shall see. How about you? What are your feelings on King Kong, Godzilla, the rest of the Titans, the rest of the Monsterverse that is being slowly built up? Give me a call. Let me know. Leave a message at 602-635-6976 or shoot me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can also ask your questions over on Twitter @sliceofscifi or over on Blue Sky @sliceofscifi.com. And as always, you can come to the website, sliceofscifi.com, and leave your comments or questions in the discussion section for this episode. Before getting into the rest of the outro promotional section for Slice of Sci-Fi, I'd like to mention that a book that I was co-editor for is finally available. Came out this week. It's about the women of the original, the classic Star Trek series, the characters and the real life women who made the show what it is. It's called Women Take the Con, an unauthorized Star Trek essay collection by women writers. Rich Handley, who I've talked to here before several times and is a friend, asked me if I'd like to help him edit this collection of Star Trek women written by women. And I said, Sure. Even though I'm not the most knowledgeable or rabid Star Trek fan out there, I do appreciate the show. I appreciate the series. I appreciate what it's done for science fiction over the decades. And we had a lot of fun putting these essays together into this collection. And I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book about how the women of Star Trek influenced women who were either fans of science fiction or not yet fans of science fiction or not yet scientists and engineers, and what seeing those women of Star Trek on the screen did for them. These essays are interpretations of various characters throughout the original series, including the movies featuring the original cast members. So go check that out. The foreword is written by Jacqueline Lichtenberg, and the introduction is written by Rich Handley, and the afterword is written by me. And to give you a taste of what's in the book, Rich's essay is about Lucille Ball and how she single-handedly saved Star Trek. And my essay is about the Enterprise. So go check that out. I'll have a link to that in the show and on the website as well. Like I said, the book just came out this week, so I'm a little bit excited about that. And if you do check it out, thank you. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Player FM, and iHeartRadio. And if you're listening on Apple or following along on Podchaser, please consider leaving us a review or a rating. Let folks know you are enjoying this show, and maybe others should check it out for themselves. We are slowly building up more content for our YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/@sliceofscifi. You can usually see the video reviews that Noah and Lewis do over there. There are also some bonus video extras that I'm slowly putting together to post over there. For instance, there's a video version of the interview that Tim Callender and I did with Nick Tate, who played Captain Alan Carter in Space 1999. That was a hilarious and delightful conversation, and the video for it is almost finished. You can check the audio version out here as well. I'd like to thank everyone who's currently helping to support the efforts here at Slice of Sci-Fi and all the shows and websites in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe. Your donations through PayPal, your pledges through Patreon really do help keep things online here. The media hosting, the website hosting, the work that goes into keeping the websites updated, all of that is helped through your support. And I am truly thankful and grateful for all of you who are donating and pledging. If you'd like to add your support, there are bonuses available. Folks who pledge through Patreon and those who support through monthly donations through PayPal, all of you are eligible for perks. If you sign up through Patreon, you can pick different levels, but everybody is eligible to win a perk every month. I pick a random number email address out of the hat, and that person gets to choose from a book, a DVD, a Blu-ray, a 4K, selected from the many review materials I get here because I can't keep it all. So having some of this material get rehomed to fans and supporters here, that's, you know, I consider that a bonus. I'm happy to make other people happy with these movies and books. Season 14 and season 15 of Supernatural are available for perks, and nobody's picked those up yet. Nobody's picked up Dragon Slayer, the 4K that came out last year either. Maybe I should do a giveaway for those. Just throw the door wide open to everybody on our social media and give those away. I'll think about it. Anyway, the place to sign up is patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi, where you can, as I said before, pick a tier, any tier. And if you're inclined to support but don't want to commit to a monthly pledge, just donate now and then. The link to use is paypal.me/sci-fi-summer. You can also choose to support by purchasing items from our select shop, that's sliceofscifi.net. All of the links there are affiliate links, so any DVD or book you purchase through there will kick us back a few pennies, and that's another way to support our efforts here, as well as purchase some of the not as well known, in some cases, movies and TV shows that we like around here. For instance, there's a little indie movie that came out a couple years ago called Fast Color. It's a superhero movie that you've never heard of, and it's absolutely gorgeous. So go check out sliceofscifi.net. I am slowly adding stuff to it every now and then, and I should probably go check new stuff to add to it right now. Anyway, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next time. Take care.